Good morning on a cold day. I'm Christopher Purdy. Welcome to today's edition of All Sides Weekend. And as they say in the circus, boy, do I have a show for you. Today we're going to talk about a play called The Rubenstein Kiss by James Phillips, which is coming to Columbus in a few weeks thanks to the good folks at Catco Phoenix. It opens February 3rd and runs for, I believe, through the 19th of February. This play is based on the Julius and Ethel Rosenberg case of the 1950s. They were the couple convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage of selling atomic secrets to the Russians, for which they were both executed in the electric chair in 1953. So we have a lot to cover today. We will do that with Stephen Anderson, who is the artistic director of Catco Phoenix and who has brought this play to Columbus. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Christopher.
David Steven is professor of law at The Ohio State University. He has a co-appointment with the Department of History, and he will fill us in on the historical and political ramifications of the case as they relate to the play. Welcome, Professor.
Very nice to be here.
Thank you for being here. And the best for last, Kim Garrison Hopcraft is an actress. She is featured in this production of Rubenstein Kiss, playing the Ethel Rosenberg character, whose name is?
Esther Rubenstein.
Esther Rubenstein. Let's begin. Stephen Anderson, what attracted you to this play?
Well, I'm always interested in plays that deal with historical events. We've done a number of them at Catco. I think I probably better start moving away from them. But I'd always been fascinated by the Rosenbergs. And so when I read this play, it wasn't so much the case, though, as the way in which the playwright used the case to talk about our human condition and the way in which we are constantly looking for safety and security. And it's really not possible.
Regardless of your political beliefs then or now, this is a devastating story, and I would think lends itself to drama. It's been dramatized before, but this is a new play. Did it come from London?
Yes, it was produced in London. James Phillips is the playwright, and he will be coming to join us for the opening and for some conversations that you're going to be a part of on February 1st at Catco at 7 o'clock.
And David, can you give us a thumbnail, but really a précis of who were Julius and Ethel Rosenberg? Why are we still talking about them 60 years later?
Well, things to know. First, Julius was at the center of a ring of spies. He was also a member of the American Communist Party. And that was a very controversial thing because the claim of members of the party was that they didn't commit espionage, that they were essentially political people trying to improve American society and relations with the Soviet Union. And a lot of members of the Communist Party didn't spy. But in his case, he did. And Ethel, it's a more complicated question. In other words, there's no hard evidence that she was actively engaged in espionage of any kind. Her behavior after he was arrested and she was arrested strongly suggested to the outside world that she supported him in what he did. And so that's really what gets her caught up so seriously in this. Publicly, she stands by her man, right? Which doesn't mean that she ever committed any overt act of espionage. In terms of their significance later, they're arrested just as the Korean War breaks out. And they're executed just before it ends. So it really is a Korean War era story. And U.S.-Soviet relations were not good before the Korean War, but there's a sort of a degree of alarm that sweeps the country when that war takes place. And you really can't understand what happens to the Rosenbergs without keeping that firmly in mind.
Give me a little – let me ask Kim, because you are playing the Ethel Rosenberg character, so you have learned a little bit about Ethel Rosenberg herself. What have you found out about her? What strikes you about her life, and even before she became, for lack of a better word, notorious?
She's an interesting woman, a wonderful character to play. She's extremely intelligent. She was self-educated and self-taught, and she was a singer. Back in her day, very accomplished. What strikes me most about her is her, well, about both of them together, is the love that they share, the quality of that love, and how devoted they are to not only one another but their common causes. It's overwhelming, actually, to think about what she gave up to be with him and to stand by him as we've said, she stands by her man. It's overwhelming sometimes.
I have myself read extensively about them and the case, and the one thing that is repeated is no matter what you think of them, even now, everybody agrees they were absolutely devoted to one another their entire lives together, and they were executed the day after their 14th wedding anniversary. I should also mention that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg left two sons who were little boys when this happened, who were later adopted and raised and gone on to live productive lives. I don't mean to sound patronizing with that, but that's a point, that they had two little children all the time that they were in prison up until the very end. Can you, David, tell us a little bit about the one thing that Julius Rosenberg always said? He was very proud that Ethel, when she was 18 years old, led a walkout, led a strike of the company where she was working for better working conditions and wages. Now, she was fired for her pains, but she did that. What was the climate like for people who were working for a living in the late 1930s?
Well, the Great Depression goes on and on in the 1930s, and there's some economic improvement and some New Deal programs that drive down unemployment. But the Depression doesn't really go away as an economic disaster until World War II. And if you're in a great big urban center, and the Rosenbergs are from New York, it has a very radicalizing experience potentially, because you see all of these people who ordinarily would be employed and productive members of society with nothing to do, right, and often living sort of just barely getting by. There's very little starvation. There's lots of malnutrition. In other words, people who don't eat well enough. It's extremely harmful to the generation that grows up in the 1930s if you're small and you don't eat properly as a kid. So they're in the middle of that. There are a lot of very poor people around them, a lot of radical political movements protesting that situation. What's interesting to me about her is in some ways she's the stronger personality. It takes strength to lead a strike, right? Even an unsuccessful one.
Even when you're 18.
When you're 18, right. In other words, I think for viewers today or listeners today, someone like Norma Rae, right? That kind of personality. He is a more easygoing in some ways kind of person. So they reinforce each other. They see different qualities in each other. They have the same basic political philosophy, but they aren't exactly alike in other ways. And I'm sure Kim can talk more about that because she thinks about this on a daily basis, preparing for the play. So one thing I wanted to mention, because you brought it up about the children, one of the things that makes her controversial is that they're 50s people, literally and figuratively. They marry young. They have kids young. They have small children. They fit in a way that mental image we have of American families in the 50s. But once they're arrested, if she had conducted herself differently, she could very well have escaped the death sentence. And so people are bothered by this. In other words, one sort of undercurrent of complaint about her in the culture is that she chooses her husband over her children, right? And so not that I have a conclusion about that. I just note it. In other words, at a time when Americans gave a very high importance to raising small children successfully, and also at a time when there were more small children in the American landscape than ever before or since because of the baby boom. So it is a 50-story that way.
Also, whatever your political affiliations, you have to respond to what is a human tragedy, no matter what you feel. Stephen Anderson, the name of the play is The Rubenstein Kiss. And there's a reason for that. First of all, they've changed the names, but this is the story of Ethel Rosenberg. But the kiss of the title, you use a rather iconic photograph to promote drawing to promote the play. But there is a woman in New York named Miriam Moskowitz, who is now 96 and feisty and active and focused, who was in jail with Ethel in Ethel's in 1950. And Miriam Moskowitz tells us about that kiss.
The house of detention where Ethel and I were jailed used to be on 6th Avenue between 9th and 10th Streets. And when the van came to load us up to take us to court, Ethel and Julius would be in that van. And it was pitch black in there. And one time a prisoner lit a cigarette, and in the flickering light we saw Ethel and Julie trying to kiss through that gate.
Stephen Anderson, tell us about that image of the kiss, because there is a bona fide photograph of the two of them
there
kissing
is.
Through a grate.
And in fact, James Phillips saw that photograph, the playwright, and this was his first play, by the way. And he tried to get a lot of playwrights interested in this story because he was just fascinated by the pure passion of this photograph, and it is a really passionate and strong image. And and then he'd put it aside for a while, and then he would find that he'd open a book and there'd be something else about the Rosenbergs, and he'd get re-engaged with it. So he finally decided that he was supposed to write this play, and so that's how the play actually came to being.
The image of the kiss, Kim, must stay with you and Cal, who plays the Julius figure, as you rehearse, as you learn more. Would you rather not have had that image in your head, or would you? Is it helpful to you?
It's actually a very helpful image to have. I can only speak for myself, but I think that Cal would agree. It's their passion. It underlies everything that they do. It's in fact, we've talked about in rehearsals, every time there's an opportunity for us to touch, we do that. They're just in constant contact with one another, whether it be, you know, they're looking at one another or touching one another. So mentally and physically, they are just completely as one. They act as one all the time. So it does help. The image does help us. It was a little difficult to recreate it, but but it does help us.
There is apparently Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, once they were imprisoned, were almost never allowed to be in each other's company unless they were handcuffed. Mm-hmm. So they really could not touch each other. There was one exception where there was a meeting with their attorneys, and they were freed, and they went at each other so much that they were – that's when it was decided they must never touch each other again, which again was – you know, that's again part of the human tragedy of this. We're going to take a break in just a moment. Let me remind everybody, we are talking about James Phillips' play, The Rubenstein Kiss, which is based on the Julius and Ethel Rosenberg case of the 1950s. It opens at Catco Phoenix February 3rd and runs through the 19th. It is directed by Stephen Anderson, the artistic director of Catco Phoenix, who is my guest, along with Professor David Stebbin of the Moritz School of Law at The Ohio State University, and Kim Garrison Hopcraft, who plays the Ethel Rosenberg character in the play. We'll have a lot more to talk about, and we'll want your phone calls when we come back. I'm Christopher Purdy for All Sides Weekend. Don't go away.
You have to feel for Mitt Romney. He's the obvious nominee, but everybody says, well, let's see how you do in Iowa. He wins Iowa, everybody says, wait for New Hampshire. He dominates New Hampshire, everybody says, well, how about South Carolina? We'll finally accept Mitt Romney as the GOP nominee a few weeks after his inauguration, unless Tim Tebow jumps up on the podium. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the inevitable news quiz from NPR.
Wait, don't tell me, tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. 19 degrees in downtown Columbus with cloudy skies. Expect some light snow showers today, about another inch of accumulation and areas of blowing snow as well. A high of 23. There's also a chance of some snow tonight. We could see another half an inch, a low of 19 degrees. Mostly cloudy for Saturday, a high of 25, and partly sunny on Sunday, and a high of 30 degrees. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, back with my guest talking about The Rubenstein Kiss, a play by James Phillips, opening at Catco Phoenix on February 3rd, based on the story of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Our number is 292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's a 614 number, 292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or find us on our Facebook page. Stephen Anderson, what has been the rehearsal period been like? First of all, this is the American premiere of the play.
It is, in fact. It's the American premiere. And the play takes place in two distinctly different periods. One, when the Rosenbergs are, you know, prior to their accusation and execution, and one with a young man who tries to discover some more information about the case. So my job, being the eldest of the crew, is to help them understand what it was like in 1975, because, yes, I do recall very well what it was like in 1975.
But you don't recall 1953.
I was born in 1953. Okay. Okay. Full disclosure, and I do not remember the Rosenbergs.
Okay. Okay.
So that's been a distinctly interesting piece to help the actors get into that world, and also into a pre-nuclear war world, and one in which how do we feel about this bomb that explodes in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so all of those historical pieces become a part of the rehearsal process, as well as the individual inspection of characters and playing real people.
I met most of your actors in this production the other night, and they all could be my children and yours too.
Yes.
So I was wondering, Kim, what did you and your colleagues know about the Rosenberg case before you got immersed in this work?
I can only speak for myself, but I didn't know much of anything at all. Mm. When I first saw the photograph, I asked my mother. And she graduated from high school in 1943, and my parents got married in 1952. So she was aware, very much aware, growing up in Philadelphia, and she remembers the photograph being published in the paper. So she was very aware. So she's been helpful in giving me a little bit of insight, but I really didn't know anything about the case.
There are three couples. There are the younger couple who live in 1975. Mm-hmm. There are the Julius and Ethel characters. And then there's Ethel's brother and his wife. Mm-hmm. Professor Stebbin, who is David Greenglass?
Well, he is a machinist who works on the Manhattan Project. He's not high level. He doesn't have access to things that are heavily classified, but he's there. And so he has access to people who sometimes give him things. And Julius recruits his brother-in-law, Ethel's brother, David. David is less politicized than either his sister or his sister's husband. But he does do this. He wants to be helpful and so on. And I think he does have qualms, as others did at the time, about whether or not this new and very destructive nuclear technology ought to be shared, right, with the Soviet Union after the war. And people differ on that. There's a split within the scientific community in the United States, some scientists saying the Soviets will develop this anyway. If we share it with them now, in return for sharing, we may be able to slow down or prevent an arms race. Others disagree and say that's naive, and Stalin's government is not a friendly, normal kind of government, especially by the late 1940s. But the point is, David is the one who literally comes up with some hard pieces of information that are of some use to the Soviet Union. So he supplies the information to Julius. Julius supplies it to someone else in the chain, and eventually that information gets back to the Soviet Union. He's not happy to be the first person identified by the FBI, and so he confesses and implicates Julius. And he blames Julius, from what I can tell from having read about the case, as the instigator of the whole thing. In other words, you're the one who got me into trouble because you recruited me to do this. And Julius, if you will just confess and implicate somebody else farther up the chain, then your life will be spared, Ethel's life will be spared. And so he is angry at his brother-in-law for having gotten into this mess, and he's angry at his sister and his brother-in-law because they don't do the normal thing at that time, which is confess.
David Greenglass, as far as I know, is still living. He would probably be 90 years old now. He has lived under an assumed name in complete incognito since he left prison in 1960. I think he got 11 years and did 8, something like that, while his sister was executed. His wife, Ruth, is also a character in the play. Ruth is very badly burned in the play, which did happen in their marriage. And I think it was they used Ruth to threaten David. You know, if you turn your sister in, we'll spare your wife. So how's that dynamic working out, Stephen, in the play and in your rehearsal of the play?
Well, it's a classic kind of conflict, isn't it? It's choice between – it's Sophie's choice, if you will. It's do I save my sister, do I save my wife? To be put in that position – it seems to me really an egregious injustice, and David can correct me if he wants, but it appears to me that they weren't so interested in the Rosenbergs as they were in getting more names. This is the period of McCarthy and the Red Scare, and it was government gone awry, in my opinion, in which it didn't matter how many people were chewed up as we got to our goal.
That's another thing that's interesting. There was nothing noteworthy about Julius and Ethel Rosenberg as people. He was a not successful engineer. He graduated near the bottom of his class at City College. He never really made it in terms of making a living. Ethel had wanted to be an opera singer, but didn't have the wherewithal, didn't have the means to get the education and the training. They had two kids, and they lived on the Lower East Side, where they both, I guess, were born and raised. Of all people, why was the roulette wheel kind of spun for these two? I mean, they both had Communist Party memberships. But I think back then, didn't most everybody have Communist Party memberships in that social circle?
Well, the Communist Party of the United States is an unusual political party in the 30s and the 40s, because at no time is it a large group, at no moment. But there are a lot of people who join briefly and go to a few meetings and decide it isn't for them, right? Because it's very centrally directed from above. So my joke to students, and I teach this period at OSU in both history and law, is that if the donkey is the symbol of the Democrats and the elephant is the symbol of the Republicans, the revolving door should have been the logo of the old American Communist Party, because a lot of people pass through it briefly and are influenced by it. Now, in New York City, which had more Communist Party members than anywhere else, there are more people. So in their world, being members or at least people who go to meetings would not have been necessarily all that unusual. But it's also a kind of hermetically sealed world. Your politics in that era tends to define who your friends are, more so than some other eras in American history. And so the idea that their politics brought them together romantically makes sense to me. It's one of the bonds in their lives.
Well, didn't they have a sort of romantic notion about the Soviet Union?
That's right.
And we weren't completely certain what was going on there. I mean, they thought it was a sort of leveler of people, that people, poor people, could be taken care of.
Right. There are two factors at work. One is that the official message of the party leadership is, don't believe all the bad things that liberals and conservatives in America say about the Communist Party and the Soviet Union. They're making it up. In other words, because they don't like communism. And if the only people you know are communists, your social world is, in a way, it's a little bit like the talk radio world of today. If the only people you talk to about politics operate from exactly the same assumptions and so on, it can limit your understanding of what's going on. The second factor is that, of course, the United States and the Soviet Union are wartime allies. And so from this period, from this Pearl Harbor through the end of the war in Europe in May of 45, the popular culture has more friendly pro-Soviet messages in it, in order to sort of encourage the American people to support the alliance. And so if you're sort of a young, impressionable adult in that era, it's possible to have sort of positive feelings about the Soviet Union and to be unaware of others. Now, in fairness to the Soviet Union and the Communist Party, in 1957, they announced that they've investigated Stalin's crimes after his death, and he committed a lot of these things, at which point 90% of the membership of the old American Communist Party leaves.
We have an email from Sarah who writes, I'm very interested in this story. I can remember getting under my desk during drills in the Cold War, and I have a vivid memory of my uncle talking and yelling about traitors to America during that time. She asks, is this a documentary-type play, or is it a fictionalized version of the story? So let's clarify that, really, Stephen.
It is a fictionalized version of the play. The play has a different purpose than to talk about it, to examine the Rosenbergs. It happens that you get a lot of information about the Rosenbergs that's pretty accurate. But the play is really about how events that happened before we're alive can be a part of our DNA.
We are not playing their guilt or innocence in this at all.
You're telling a human story.
We are.
Not political stories.
Correct.
Political just is sort of like a pea. It's the elephant in the room, really, but it's not really the core of the play. Having read it myself, I haven't seen it, but
It's not the core. It's easier for me, as David said, there's no evidence really very much against Ethel. It's a bit harder, I believe, for Cal to come to grips with.
Who plays Julius,
the Julius character, comes to grips with what he did. It's harder for him. It's the harder thing for me to play is, as a mother myself, that she left her children. That's the hardest thing for me to play in the show.
Is this a fair question? Have you forgiven her for that?
You know, that's a great question to ask. I believe I have. We talked the other day when we were doing table work about a love like this Romeo and Juliet type of love that they shared. You do not see often in history. You do not see it with the people that you know. I mean, I adore my husband, and we just celebrated our 14th wedding anniversary. But if I had to choose between my children or saving the lives of my children, I would either take my own or I would throw – I told him the other day I would throw you under the bus.
I don't think she meant it.
I didn't mean it. But so I do believe that type of passion we just don't see and we just don't understand it. And if you look at their relationship that way, it does give a sense of forgiveness to them.
I think that the choice was not so much for her love for him, though, that as it was for the cause, that she believed in the cause and in the world being a better place.
Because they were equal on that level, completely equal in their belief system.
We have a cut now I'd like to offer you. This is the day of the execution. This is newsreel footage so that the sound quality won't be great. But this is July 19th, 1953. It's David Brinkley. Ask your grandmother if you don't know. I mean, David Brinkley on NBC is reporting the last-minute attempts to save their lives. And we'll also hear the voice of the Rosenberg's attorney, Emanuel Bloch. And, David, I want to ask you about him when we come back.
The court had refused again to delay the execution. A few minutes later, Emanuel Bloch, chief counsel, came out, read us a telegram he had sent to the president.
For sake of American tradition, prestige, and influence, urge redress for Rosenberg. Demand you be afforded sufficient time to consider this serious matter.
The president's answer came quickly.
Only most extraordinary circumstances could warrant executive intervention in the case. When democracy's enemies have been judged guilty of a crime as horrible as that of which the Rosenbergs were convicted, when the legal processes of democracy have been marshaled to their maximum strength to protect the lives of convicted spies, when in their most solemn judgment the tribunals of the United States have adjudged them guilty and the sentence just, I will not intervene in this matter.
Anybody wanting to know more about the Rosenberg case can do no better than to find a DVD of a documentary produced by their granddaughter, whose name is Ivy Mirapol, called Heir to an Execution. It's very, very, very compelling, very moving, and very honest. Heir to an Execution, a film by Ivy Mirapol. I think the Columbus Library has, the local libraries have it. David Stabenow, other legal scholars have named Emanuel Bloch, the attorney for the Rosenbergs, as a hero. He never, ever gave up, and he died. He had a heart attack and died a few months after the executions. What do you know about Emanuel Bloch?
Well, not a lot, a little. And what I would say is that his belief in them, that they were entitled to a good defense and that the punishment being meted out to them was disproportionate was total. So he's very committed to his clients. He's an advocacy kind of attorney. The criticism of him among legal scholars is that he was not the most highly effective lawyer in defending them. In other words, a more mainstream, high-powered lawyer might have been more successful, although it's hard to say, we'll never know. And so it, to me as a legal historian, it reflects the sort of the mixed value of someone who's very passionately committed to you and your case, but isn't necessarily the most highly trained or effective attorney. But that said, it would have been very hard for the Rosenbergs to obtain a sort of more mainstream and high-powered lawyer, because those kinds of lawyers didn't want to represent people like the Rosenbergs.
We are going to take another break in just a few moments, but I wanted to really ask Kim, how hard is it? When you play this character, you know what's going to happen to her, even if some of the audience do not. Carrying that around in your head, is that especially devastating or difficult, or can you as an actress not know that?
No, it's very difficult. Lucky for me, Stephen understands my process. I'm very emotional. It's been very difficult to get through some scenes, knowing what happens in the end. But what really helps is that she is the strong one. She really is the rock. So I just have to find those moments when it's okay for her to show her vulnerability. She doesn't do it often.
No, she doesn't
do it often. So to play her strength is what I really have to focus on.
And we've used two or three boxes of tissues in the room. We've been working.
The number is 292-8513 if you'd like to call and join in the conversation. We're talking about The Rubenstein Kiss, a play by James Phillips based on the case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg that's opening at Catco Phoenix on February 3rd. 292-8513. You can also send an email to WOSU.org. We have a call from Nancy, and this call relates to you, Kim. Hello, Nancy. Are you there?
Yes, I remember reading a collection of letters of American women that spanned from the Revolutionary War to the 1990s, and there was a letter written by Ethel to her children on June 19, 1953. Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, we do have a copy of that. Actually, we did a question and answer conversation at the Jewish Community Center last week, and lovingly I was asked by Stephen and Christopher if I would read that letter at the end of that evening, and it was extremely difficult to read that letter.
And it was, I hate to say, magnificent when I say it that way. I understand what I mean, but it was incredible the way you did that.
Thank you very much for that.
That letter was written moments before she was executed.
She put the pencil down and was taken out, yeah. And I have a copy on my desk. I was going to ask you to do it again, but that's unfair on the radio, so I don't think we're going to do that right now. We've got to take a break for 90 seconds, and then we'll be back. Again, the number is 292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. Back in 90 seconds.
The FX series Justified begins its third season next week. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Timothy Oliphant, who plays U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens. And he'll tell us about his work on other shows, including Deadwood, The Office, and Damages. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And right now, you have an opportunity to help shorten the upcoming winter membership drive. Become a sustaining member right now. For every 100 sustaining members we receive, we will eliminate one day from our membership drive. As a sustaining member of 89.7 NPR News, your membership never expires and your member card renews annually. But right now, you have an opportunity to help take one day off of our drive. Visit WOSU.org and make your sustaining gift today. And thanks for your support. 19 degrees with cloudy skies and some light snow in downtown Columbus. Expect about an inch of snow accumulation today and a high of 23. There's a chance of about a half an inch of snow for tonight, a low of 19 degrees. Cloudy skies for Saturday, a high of 25, and some light snow Saturday night, a low of 19. And then partly sunny, looking ahead to Sunday with a high of 30. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy for All Sides Weekend with David Stebbin, who is professor of law at the OSU Moritz School of Law and also has a joint appointment with the Department of History at The Ohio State University. Stephen Anderson is the artistic director of Cat Cove Phoenix, and Kim Garrison Hopcraft is an actress, and she is featured in the production of The Rubenstein Kiss by James Phillips, the play based on the Rosenberg story that opens at Cat Cove Phoenix February 3rd. One thing that one of your actors, Stephen, said to me, he asked, do we have any recordings of their voices, of Julius and Ethel speaking? There's lots of newsreel footage of them coming in and out of jail, et cetera, but I'm not aware. I've never heard either of their voices, and I think that's an interesting question.
The world is so – it's so easy to do research. You can also get bad research, of course, but you know, go to YouTube and you can find an extraordinary amount of newsreels and commentaries about the events surrounding them, but I've never seen them interviewed.
I've never heard either one of them speak, and that's because if this today, I mean, my goodness, they would have been everywhere. You mentioned, David, that Ethel, we didn't ever see Ethel break down.
Right, and so if you're the sort of person who's trying to figure out what is this person like, right, in an era in which you have very traditional gender roles, gender relationships, she doesn't get weepy. She doesn't cry ever, and if you photograph her in an unsympathetic way, and a lot of the news photography did, right, she can look cold and not even feminine, right? And then, of course, she chooses her husband over her children, it is said, and their politics transcend their personal commitment. And that, so you can see how you can demonize her, and much of the mainstream media at that time did.
She is really the iconic figure more than Julius. Would you agree on that?
Well, I don't know about that. They're both small fish in the world of espionage, right? They're undistinguished people in many ways in that sense. They're not leaders of some vast conspiracy. They're these sort of obscure people who are caught up in this momentous event. And I have to say, I was skeptical when I was first asked to comment on this play, both at the Jewish Community Center and then here, that I would find much in it that would be new, because there is a lot written about this. But the script is really interesting to me, because I had given no thought to what it would be like to be a child of the Rosenbergs or of the Greenglasses, David Greenglass, as adults. In other words, how you would feel about that. And to me, the best thing about this is there's a political side to this play, but it's very much a family story as well. So you can relate to it on a human level, even if you don't know a lot going in.
I think the way the media treated this situation is very different from the way we would have now. In fact, there's that incredibly iconic photograph of the two boys, 4 and 7, reading the newspaper, the headlines of which are spies executed in one day. I mean, to use innocent children in
like
that way to forward an agenda, it seems to me. If you're interested in seeing that photograph, we have a Facebook fan page on the Rubenstein Kiss. You can go to it by www.facebook.com/Rubenstein Kiss. And there's actually an entire examination of from the very first conversations we had to the present of design.
We have a lot of calls waiting now, and Margie from Columbus has been waiting longest. Hi there.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, as I listen to you all, I find myself wondering, was there one significant event that happened in the world or action they did or a person that impacted the outcome? Like, was it J. Edgar Hoover? Was it McCarthy? Or was it just the totality of how people viewed communism at the time?
Thank you. Go ahead. David?
Well, it's a great question, and I can't answer all aspects of it now. To the extent there's a view that at the time that the Rosenbergs, however unwittingly, have caused tremendous harm, it sort of goes as follows. They helped the Soviets develop a bomb. an atomic bomb. They might not have. They might have succeeded anyway, but it would have taken the Soviet Union longer to do so. Because they succeed fairly quickly in developing a bomb, they are less intimidated by the United States, and Stalin doesn't tell the leader of North Korea, when the leader of North Korea goes to see him in the fall of 1949, Stalin could have said, don't attack South Korea. Instead, Stalin is more ambivalent about it, said, well, if you want to do this, you go ahead. And so there's a school of thought at the time that blames the Korean War itself on the Rosenberg's espionage, because it puts the Soviet Union in a different geopolitical position by the fall of 1949 when they explode their first atomic bomb.
We have a call from Mike in Columbus. Speaking of the atomic bomb, he has a comment related to that. Mike, hi there. Are you there?
Hi, yes. This should be a really fascinating play. I'm looking forward to it. I just finished an interesting book called The Bomb, A Life. And it's the whole history of the development of the bomb scientifically and historically, culturally. And I never really realized or appreciated that the scientists at that time and many others saw the bomb as a force for peace, that humanity would come to the point of saying, we can no longer have war, we can utterly destroy ourselves. Once people find out about this, and it's not just the U.S., but everybody has the bomb, we'll have to outlaw war. Of course, it didn't quite work out so well, but there were people, Oppenheimer, many, many of the scientists really saw the bomb as a force of peace.
Mike, thank you for that comment. That's a very good – I see heads nodding in assent. That's right. This is – in fact, a little bit related to that, we have a an email from Hal. What role do you think the Rosenbergs, being Jewish, played in their lives and death?
Right, and that's another strand of this. One of the reasons I like this play is because there are a lot of different things going on. The adult population of the United States in 1950, when they're arrested and indicted, would have grown up in a popular culture where there were many more anti-Semitic messages, sometimes very overt, than in the second half of the 20th century, with which most people today are more familiar. In other words, World War II and the Nazis tend to drive underground and reduce overt anti-Semitic messages. But if you're 45 years old in 1950, an ordinary citizen, a juror on the case, something like that, you've grown up in a culture that's been had a lot of these messages. So one undercurrent question is, was the sentence disproportionately harsh because they were in fact Jews from New York City and therefore exotic and maybe not fully loyal, all these kinds of prejudices that circulated in the culture at the time?
And we have a call from Richard who has a good point. Richard, hi, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Two questions I had. One is, there's a school of thought that they were guilty and deserved to die. And the other, wasn't there a novel about their children?
Yes, there's a novel called The Book of Daniel by E.L. Doctorow, which was it was made into a movie called Daniel. I think Timothy Hutton and Amanda Plummer were in it. I recommend them both. But so your question is really, I mean, they could have been guilty. It could have been deserved. Has that been in the conversation over 60 years? Has that been really confronted?
Well, the issue of guilt, he's clearly guilty of committing espionage. In other words, what we have today makes that clear. The case still, however, raises issues. The only definitive testimony against her comes from David Greenglass, who later says that he's not sure that what he said about her was in fact true. He just doesn't remember, right? And so, but he was prompted by the prosecution team to enhance his testimony, if you want to put it that way, in order to secure a conviction of her. And the reason for this on the prosecution side is they want to convict her as well as him so that they can pressure him to confess and name more names. And what really surprises the prosecution and the FBI investigation team is that she never does. In other words,
she called their bluff.
Right, that's right. And so, and that was very unusual. She never persuades him to change his mind. He never changes his mind. But there also are other aspects. Did they get a fair trial? And then it's also a capital punishment landmark case in the sense that they are executed for treason. In the execution itself is an especially grisly affair with respect to her.
In fact, our last sound cut is Bob Considine from Hearst Newspapers a few moments after the executions giving his eyewitness account for the press. Here that is.
When it appeared that she had received enough electricity to kill an ordinary person and had received the exact amount that had killed her husband, the doctors went over and pulled down the cheap prison dress, a little dark green printed job, and placed the stethoscopes to her and then looked around, looked at each other rather dumbfounded and seemed surprised that she was not dead. Believing she was dead, the attendants had taken off the ghastly strappings and electrodes and the black belts and so forth. And these had to be readjusted again, and she was given more electricity, which started again that kind of a ghastly plume of smoke that rose from her head and went up against the skylight overhead. After two more of those jolts, Ethel Rosenberg had met a maker. She'll have a lot of explaining to do, too.
That's Bob Considine at Sing Sing, having just witnessed the executions. That's pretty raw. I'm sorry if that upset anybody out there, but I did want to sort of make the point of what a devastating political tragedy, personal tragedy this was, regardless of your politics. And you made the point, David, that the horror of this has really stayed with people ever since.
Right. You could literally just hive off the part that has to do with the issues of capital punishment and the issues raised by this trial, irrespective of all the other factors, and have a lively discussion, continuing attention to the event.
Stephen Anderson, when we go and see the Rubenstein Kiss, which opens February 3rd at Catco Phoenix down in the Rife Center, what can we expect?
I think you can expect an evening of warmth, oddly, and a story well told and several surprises.
Talk a little more. I mean, sell me. Come on. Tell me. Let's go.
Yeah, right. Well,
because I've just sort of brought the room way down.
Yeah, no, you
let's
have.
I want to go a little bit more.
The play is an extraordinary piece of storytelling, and it shows us these two people in a very human kind of way, and doesn't try to say that they were guilty or innocent. It says that they were, and I think that. In a world in which we create demagogues and demonize others, I think that remembering our own humanity is a part that the theater should play, and that's the part that this does play.
Kim, as you rehearse and prepare the role with Cal, give me his full name.
Yes, Cal Poole.
Cal Poole, who plays the Julius character. Do you have discussions with him by yourself, just the two of you, about particularly about what your lives and outlook as parents are doing to your interpretations or your performances? How important is parenthood to your character?
You know, that's interesting. We haven't officially blocked the final scene where we write the letter to our son together. We haven't talked about that. Both Cal and I are parents, so he has two little girls, and I have my two, a son and a daughter. So it's something. I'm glad you brought that up, because we do need to talk about that scene for certain. We haven't done any table work on it as yet. So the idea of writing a message to your children that you want them to hold on to for a lifetime, just a piece of paper that will help them to understand who you are and why you did what you did. It's pretty overwhelming. That letter that we talked about before is all they leave their boys.
If people want to, they can find a copy of that letter online, Ethel Rosenberg's final letter to her children. I I think we're all going to want to jump off a bridge because it's very difficult. It's very beautiful and very, very difficult. One of the final scenes of the play, Stephen, recreates their last meeting together an hour before their deaths. And even then, David, they were not allowed to touch.
Right.
They met
three plies of mesh,
and they apparently touched their fingers through the wires, through the screens
until they bled.
Yeah, and that's you can't write that, really. You really can't write that. That's exactly what happened at the time. So I don't want people to come away from this program thinking that this is the most depressing and horrible play that was ever written, and why would anybody go to this? So that's why I keep asking you, Stephen, and you, Kim, to really make the point that it is about humanity, and you will also see you'll see some great acting. If you're interested in the technique and the art of acting and drama, this is the place to be starting February 3rd. We have a call. We just had enough time to this call. I'm glad this caller has the question. It's from Stephen in Columbus. Stephen, hi. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
I wanted to ask if you could, without putting you on the spot, and I've never had the chance to ask an actress, how do you repeat that performance, that emotional level, night after night?
Good question. Thank you, Stephen.
That's a great question. A lot of it comes from the other actors on the stage. I get tons and tons of energy from Cal, and we've only just begun this process. We have a few more weeks to go, and there are some amazing actors in this play. And I think that the audience also feeds us. We always look forward to that first audience because it's amazing to see how things change when you get that energy back. It's just keeping it very honest. Honesty is the most important thing when you're on stage, in my opinion. And I just have to remember who she is and keep it honest every night, and I can do it.
Will she be the same person for you every night, do you think?
She better be.
Well,
she
no.
she will be the same person every night. She certainly will not. She will not change. Her strength, her vision, her outlook, her love for her husband and for her causes will not ever change.
David, in the few minutes we have left, can you just, if you can, fill us in on what happened to the two little boys, their sons?
Well, this is a complicated story in that...
We got 2 minutes, so...
They're orphaned.
Right.
Someone has to adopt them. People who are sort of sympathetic to the politics of the Rosenbergs are the initial adopters, and then the government is not too comfortable with that. So there's actually a struggle that takes place for this couple actually to adopt them. And the it's, again, very much a 50s story in the sense that what are proper parents? Who are proper parents for the children of the Rosenbergs? And you can have a huge argument about that in the culture of the mid-1950s, right? They should be given strongly anti-communist parents, mm-hmm. so they'll know what their parents really did and never want to be like them. By the way, in terms of this issue of is it depressing, I didn't find it so, because so much of the play looks at this from the perspective of the next generation. And again, even if you have nothing to do with communism or uninterested in it, if your parents had very different politics from yours, how are you to feel about their political commitments looking back on them later is, I think, a really interesting question.
It's quite a play about hope for the future. Really,
yeah,
is.
I agree with that, yes. Stephen, you're the only one I think who's seen the play among all of us here.
I haven't seen it either, only in my head.
Oh, I thought you saw it in London.
No,
okay, because I'm curious to know what the audiences are going to be like. I guess we'll have to come and find out.
You'll have to come and find out.
I expect they're going to get the silence that one gets, which is a compliment to the actors and to the writer. I'm Christopher Purdy. You've been listening today to All Sides Weekend here on 89.7 FM. My guests have been Professor David Stebbin, who has a dual appointment to the School of Law and Department of History at The Ohio State University. Stephen Anderson is the artistic director of CATCO Phoenix, and he is directing the production of James Phillips' play, The Rubenstein Kiss, that opens at CATCO Phoenix on February 3rd. What's your website?
CATCO is theater.org.
And tell me about Facebook real fast.
Facebook, facebook.com/RubensteinKiss, and you can see all kinds of images of designs and images from the past.
And Kim Garrison Hopcraft stars in the play and is sort of leaving her soul on the table every time she works in this. And I say that with the greatest admiration and looking forward to that. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you, Amy Jurevich. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.